Stas, welcome to the show.
Matt, thank you for having me on.
Let's start at the beginning.
Normal kind of upbringing, around about 11 years old, my mum suddenly passed away. I felt a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, a lot of hurt. I guess I channeled it in the right direction. I had what was looking or shaping up to be a promising football career. That didn't work out. I started working in a local gym. A couple of years in, I was just sort of thinking, is this it? I enrolled for the Royal Marines Commando course. The first time that I saw UK Special Forces was on that tour. That, for me, it was just a moment of how do I become one of those guys.
I read something about your parachute incident.
I just remember sort of going through the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, something doesn't feel right. My oxygen mask had been ripped off, kind of trying to look up, but I couldn't.
When you started Foodart, was it a big plan to be a business owner?
We love being outside, but let's make clothing and equipment that we like.
You had to sell your military medals to assist in the finance.
That was a difficult decision. Drowning sailors don't hold on to gold bars.
Guys, Matt Haycock's here. And welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycock Show. This is one that we are streaming live on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter and YouTube. So if you're not watching it live, you'll be able to catch up on iTunes and Spotify over the next week or two. But today we have got a military legend, a special forces operator and a successful entrepreneur. Today's guest has served in elite military units. He's conducted countless high-stakes missions. He's earned prestigious honours. He's had a 13-year military career, and he's spent a decade in the Special Forces. Now, after leaving, he went on to found a multi-million pound technical clothing company, Foodart. He's also just released an incredible book, which I've started to read, but admittedly haven't quite finished yet, but I'm very excited to get there. But I know from doing the research for this podcast that both the podcast is going to be great and the book is going to be amazing. So Stas, welcome to the show.
Matt, thank you for having me on, and what an incredible intro. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure you'll live up to every word of it, buddy. I'm very, very excited.
I hope so. Hope so. Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, look, let's start at the beginning. You know, give us a bit of background and talk to me about your early life and you know, what childhood was like and how you ended up in the military.
Okay, I've got a tendency to waffle, so I'll try and keep it short and succinct and to the point, or the most sort of important part. So I was born and raised for the most part up in Wigan in Lancashire, around about the age, normal kind of upbringing, an older sibling. Andrew, a couple of years older than me, just remember being outdoors loads, just playing, getting up to mischief, you know, wasn't particularly academic, but enjoyed school for the social aspects and sport in particular. And around about 8 years old, my parents split up, so they divorced. I then relocated to Nottingham with my mum. She remarried, and it was me and my brother and my mum, stepdad, sort of growing up in Mansfield, a sort of a pit sort of village, just on the outskirts of, on Mansfield. And so that's sort of 8 years old, and I'm sort of transitioning through school. And then around about, 11 years old, I kind of, just as I'm transitioning into secondary school, I guess I had my first real sort of kicking the balls, really. My mum suddenly passed away from a brain hemorrhage. So overnight, it was a surprise and a shock to everybody. Fortunately, myself and my brother were up visiting my dad at the time up in Wigan. So we didn't have to physically see, you know, what had happened. But I just remember him sitting us down, you know, up in his house up in Wigan, and just sort of having that conversation with us. But, you know, and having vivid memories of that conversation right now, and sort of trying to put myself into that position. Obviously, you know, horrible, life-changing, devastating situation to be put into, especially as a kid at that age. We went back to Nottingham. My mum was on a life support machine for approximately a week, and the decision was made to ultimately end her life and turn the life support machine off. You know, life then changed for me in particular, and my brother as well, and the rest of the family. I guess for
did
us,
you go back and live with we your dad at that point? Then did you?
So at this point, we're now in a house, and I guess with hindsight now and with age and experience, I can look back and understand what a shit situation that would have been as well for my stepdad. We didn't have a great relationship, you know. He wasn't particularly abusive, but it wasn't great. And, you know, so now we're in a house, he's just lost his wife, he's got two kids that aren't his, you know, and he's kind of thinking, you know, what's going on? Thankfully for me and my brother, the decision was made that we wouldn't move back up to Nottingham. I think, you know, we'd formed some friendship groups since moving down, since the split had happened. We were just transitioning into secondary school, et cetera, et cetera. My brother was already in there. And we decided to stay. I was sort of starting to play football, and my grandparents moved down. So they relocated from Wigan. So my mum's parents, they bought a small little bungalow in the same pit village. We moved in with those guys as quickly as we could. And off I went. I sort of started secondary school. And I guess for me, you know, I felt a lot of anger, a lot of resentment, a lot of hurt with what had happened. But again, I think if we looking back at things now, I guess I channeled it in the right direction. You know, you see a lot of kids now, or things, sometimes these things happen to people, and it can sometimes often go to two different ways. And for me, I definitely channeled that and used that kind of, I guess that energy and that fire, you know, it sort of lit a fire in my belly. And I don't know whether it was wanting to prove something, or just through the anger and the situation, I just channeled that passion and purpose into sport, you know. And around about 11 to 13, I started playing football
at quite a high level. Academic?
I was not particularly academic, but sporty, yes. So I was playing football, you know, at a high standard, a professional club affiliated to Mansfield Town. I was representing the county, et cetera, et cetera. And then went through school and was then representing England schoolboys, was then, you know, representing better teams, Fulham, all these other places. And for me, I had what was looking or shaping up to be a promising football career as a professional. Unfortunately, that didn't work out. At around about 16 or 17, I was involved in a motocross accident. I kind of dislocated my knee in a pretty bad way, had surgery, went back the first game back. I remember being at Fulham and, you know, my knee going again, sort of dislocating and just sort of punching the ground in frustration more than anything, and sort of the realization of that professional career slipping through my fingers. Actually, then I went to college, enrolled on a BTEC National Diploma course in sports science, continued to play football, was rehabbed, I was still playing at a high level. And then I was representing the British colleges football, traveled the world, went everywhere. And then I got offered a university scholarship in America, University of South Carolina, sort of full paid 4-year scholarship. I was 2 weeks out from traveling over to the States to enroll on that course or to start that journey. And I filled out some amateur eligibility forms incorrectly. But they deemed me to be a professional because I'd been, you know, paid to play before. I'd received contracts, I'd received royalties, that kind of stuff, which is the norm in the UK, but not in the US. So that then meant that I would have to postpone the application and go a year later, which at that time, you know, that age in your life, you're sort of 17, 18, you're just, a year seems like a decade. So, you know, for me, I left feeling disgruntled. I started working in a local gym. I was a gym instructor, a personal trainer. And I think a couple of years in, I was just sort of thinking, is this it? You know, I've gone from potentially being a professional footballer here, from this having a scholarship, and, you know, I'm now working in a local council-run gym. It's just not very inspiring. I feel like I've got more to give, you know, and more value to add, and for myself personally as well. So at that time, I started looking to different options of what I could do. I started reading books that I actually enjoyed reading rather than I was voluntold to read at school. And those were military history, you know, and in particular, sort of Andy McNab books, Special Forces and the Marines, the Paras. I started to kind of develop a keen interest in that, which, you know, for myself as well, looking back, there was no one really in my immediate family that was in the military. So there was no kind of figure or person that I was trying to emulate, or somebody that was certainly pushing me in that direction. At the time, the Gulf War was kicking off. You know, we had 9/11. There was a lot of stuff happening with the Marines, the Paras, in the mainstream media. And I thought, yeah, do you know what? Let's join something. I feel like I want to get away. I feel like I've got more to give. And so I enrolled for the Royal Marines Commando course. I went to a local Armed Forces Career Office in Nottingham. For me, it was the Marines or the Paras. It was kind of what's the hardest basic infantry soldiering course I could do. And it was the Marines or the Paras. And the guy behind the desk when I walked into the careers office was a Royal Marine. He sort of come here, son, sort of led me down that path. And I guess probably within walking into that door, I think within 6 months, I was turning up at the Commando Training Center, Royal Marines, as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed kind of civilian to embark on what is arguably the hardest basic infantry course you can undertake at 32 weeks.
And when you went into the army, were you going in with a view that this was going to be your lifelong career, or was this, you know, was this a, I guess, a not a phase, but you know what I mean? Was this to kind of, you know, get you over the hurt and get your head back into gear?
No, I think it was just a challenge. It was something that I set myself a goal and a challenge that I thought, that looks really fucking hard, you know. And also, I think if I passed that, it would give me a huge sense of achievement. So I think that was it. And also, I wanted to get away as well. And I thought that would offer me an outlet and something else that I could really enjoy. So I didn't really know how I would take it in terms of the training, whether I would enjoy that process. It's not for everybody, you know. You being screamed and shouted at. It's early mornings, you know, late nights. It's admin. It's training. It's a whole different environment and working environment, and you learn very quickly. But looking back now, it absolutely set me up for success and made me the kind of person that I am today. It set the foundations.
And how did you take to the training and the, you know, the 32 weeks or whatever you said it was? You know, I mean, because these are incredibly difficult, aren't they? And I was talking to Middleton about them the other week.
Yeah, it's yeah, it's a long time, 32 weeks. It's a long time to put your body and your mind through that kind of intense training cycle. For me, though, it's like a duck to water. I really, really relished the opportunities and the chances. I think having a really good base level of fitness from, you know, almost professional football set me up in good stead for going and entering into that world of fitness. So the fitness side of things, I was there. I was at the top of the kind of the course, or at top of the squadron, or, you know, the troop that's there. So I guess when you start, there's generally about 50 to 60 people that are in a troop. Every 2 weeks, there's a new troop that joins, and it's kind of, it goes through that cycle. In fact, myself and Ant were 2 weeks apart in terms of training. We were in the same training block, so the same accommodation. So I've known him since training. And then we went to the same commando unit when we were both in Royal Marines, and the same company. So yeah, it's 32 weeks. I really enjoyed it. Obviously, there's parts that are pretty grim, you know, when you're sat on in a sentry position in a wood block in Hungwoodbury Common at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, freezing and wet through and starving. There's grim moments, but for me, I really enjoyed the challenge. I love pushing myself physically and mentally. And by the end of the 32 weeks, you know, like I said earlier, it really did sort of shape the person that I am. And I learned a lot from that 32 weeks. I learned a lot about myself and what I was capable of physically and mentally. And I think at the end of that as well, I was awarded the King's Badge, you know, for the top recruit. And then I was also awarded the PT medal for being the fittest guy in the troop. So, you know, there were certain telltales, you know, successes leaving clues here. And I was looking back, and I was getting awarded these things and doing well in training and the soldiering side as well, I kind of really took to and enjoyed it as well. So at the end of that, I went into the, I was badged. So really, you get your belt and your beret. So you get your green beret, the coveted green beret, and your belt, and your stable belt, and you get your commando flashes that you can sew onto your uniforms. And it's a proud day. You know, you've achieved something. You've set out quite a big task, and you've achieved it, and you have that, you know, you do have that feeling, immense feeling of achievement, and rightly so as well. So after that, I went into the 40 Commando, Royal Marines, joined a commando unit, and was kind of like, okay, this is it. It's going to be full of all these kind of amazing green berets and commandos and people. And actually, and it's not to shit on them, the actual reality was that not everybody is like that. You know, not everybody is on that kind of that same thought process or that same level that you thought it would have been. And I went on my first deployment to Kabul, Afghanistan, in 2006. And again, just sort of, it's you're straight into the deep end. You have all this training, all this preparation and pre-deployment training, and you go out into theater, and it's just a madness. You know, I remember my first contact, it was just sensory overload. And honestly, not knowing what the fuck was happening, who was shooting at us, where the explosions were going, and it was just chaos, like an out of body experience.
Why is that?
As with anything in life,
is that just because of the chaos of battle and the chaos of war, or are you implying that things aren't as like military precision as the expression would make you think?
No, I think for me it is your first comment. So the chaos of war, you know, it is a confuse. The battle space is confusing, but also for me it was a lack of experience. You know, you think that you're experienced, you do all the training, and you are trained to a high level, but nothing can quite prepare you for, you know, the time when you do first deploy or when you have that first contact, and you have an idea of what you would like. How you would like to present yourself or how you would react in that situation. But look, the reality is it's like being a boxer, isn't it? You can train and spar and hit punch bags and mitts all you like, but until you step in the ring under the you know, the lights and the chaos and the noise and the crowd and somebody just throws one straight down your pipe, you don't know how you're going to react, you know, and it does catch, you know, quite a few people out. So, but that's experience, you know, and those experiences then layered on over years and multiple contacts, you become sort of battle hardened and experienced in terms of how you deal and react to those certain situations.
Well, let's talk about some of the missions over there. I mean, obviously you've seen some you know, some incredible amounts of combat, and I'm sure there's plenty of things you can't talk about, but I mean, what can you share with us that, you know, really stands out as a particularly tough mission or something that, you know, sticks out as a particular learning point in your life?
Yeah, so there's one in particular in the Marines, and it was that, you know, that first kind of contact that was just chaos. But that was more of a personal learning development thing that, you know, that I learned a lot about myself, that, you know, I could react, and that I, you know, I was there and I was able to do the basics, but also learn and develop into a better person. So that was the kind of the Marines, but also I remember being on the front gate in Kabul, Afghanistan, and the first time that I saw UK Special Forces was on that tour. You know, I was in charge, me and a few of the guys in the Marines were on duty on the main gate. You know, one of the roles and responsibilities when you weren't out on patrols was to obviously offer the camp security. So you would be, you know, at different stations. But on the main gate, we would look at the flow and ingress and egress of vehicles in and out of the camp. We would be checking passes, all that kind of usual stuff. And two civilian profile vehicles rolled in, and out jumped eight kind of cool looking operators with beards, long hair. They were dressed differently, had different kit and equipment, different, you know, weapon systems and all this kind of stuff. And they were British as well, which, you know, for me, the first time of seeing it, I'd heard about Special Forces, but they were kind of a bit of a mystery. And, you know, they're really, really nice, approachable people. They walked in, they probably had a meeting on the camp that I was working in, and then they left maybe 2 hours later. And that for me, it was just a moment of penny drop and thinking, you know, who the fuck are those guys and what are they doing and how do I become one of those guys? So that for me planted a seed on that first tour. I then went back to the Marines. I had another deployment up to Scotland, and then for me, I started thinking more and more about Special Forces selection and thinking, what do I need to do to get myself in that world? So probably arguably one of the hardest soldiering courses that you can do in the Marines and in the military in general is the sniper course. And I thought for me personally, if I could pass the sniper course, that would set me up for success for joining Special Forces. So I put myself into the sniper course. I passed the sniper course with the Royal Marines, back down at Lymston. And then for me, it was another tick, another kind of verification to say, yeah, okay, now I can go on to Special Forces selection. And it's a volunteered course, UK Special Forces. You volunteer yourself to go on to the selection process, and off I went on to selection. And, you know, and selection is fucking hell, it's probably the best job interview in the world, isn't it? You know, we're looking at everything, and it's designed in such a way to layer on complex tasks, you know, while you're tired, wet, hungry, all the usual things in the military, but just, you know, times 10 on another level. And then you've got all the weight carrying, all the navigation stuff, and it's, they say, you know, it is basic soldiering done to a very high standard, which is true. But, you know, there are more, there's definitely a very, very steep learning curve that is attached to Special Forces, and they're always layering it on constantly while you're being reviewed and watched and looked at under the watchful eyes of the DS. So selection, you know, that was 8 to 9 months, and again, I passed. I was quite fortunate. You need a bit of lady luck on your side in terms of injury. I was fine. You know, there's not anybody that doesn't go through selection without any sort of form of injury. But for me, there was nothing major. I sort of twisted ankle and a few bits and pieces, but nothing that wouldn't stop me progressing through selection. And And for me, once I'd set myself that goal and that idea, it then became like a burning desire for me. It became a real passion, and all it sort of consumed my everything, my being. That's all I could think about, all I would talk about. And I really just, for me, it was everything, because I saw it as almost like there was no plan B. It was just plan A. It was special forces, or I don't want to go back to the Marines. And if I've got to go back to the Marines, I'll leave, and then I'll probably do something else. So, you know, I really sort of I put a lot of self-induced pressure on that in terms of passing the course, and thankfully I did. I then joined, you know, one of the Sabre squadrons, and it's again snakes and ladders life. You sort of pass selection. You're a Marine, a sniper. I've got a great pass in terms of, you know, the selection. I've done well. You know, out of the 240 people that started that selection process, I think there were six of us that passed for the SBS. So that gives you kind of an indication as to the percentage and the failure rate attached to selection. And everybody on selection as well, that, you know, they're good soldiers, they're Marines, they're paras. I think Marines make up 50 to 60% of UK Special Forces. So, you know, there's a good caliber of person on that selection process. And then following that into the squadron and hit the biggest snake again, you're back to the bottom of the pile. And again, the learning starts again, and it's different. Everything is different. You know, the weapon systems and communication, everything is completely different. And when I joined in 2008, it was probably the golden years. It was the highlight of special forces operations, particularly in Afghanistan at the time. It was very kinetic. It was high value target hunting, you know, manhunting operations, but, you know, very tip of the spear, strategic level operations. And we were going out every night. Every night it was so, so busy. And the jobs were just, again, to back to your original question, any that stand out, you know, my first job in the SBS was a kind of Call of Duty style job that was just unbelievable to me. And, you know, I use the word fortunate, you know, hopefully in the right context, because, you know, war again and everything else and the battle space, I'm not trying to glamorize it by any stretch of the imagination, but it was everything that I wanted and hoped and dreamed of joining in terms of special forces and what the missions were. And they're very different to conventional Green Army missions. And then, you know, I had four operational tours throughout my kind of 10 years within special forces there. Each one of those were very different. You know, I finished my last, so the first one was really kinetic. The second one, I was out in the desert doing a mobility stuff, so more vehicle operations and interdictions in terms of cutting off the arterial routes for the drug smuggling, which was funding the terrorism and the weapons and everything else. And then I had another kinetic tour, and then I did my last tour in Kabul, and I was kind of in charge or leading a partner-led force, you know. And by that stage in 2013, it was, now we're kind of handing over the baton to the in-country partners, you know, the Afghans and their special forces and their special police. And at the end of that tour, I was recognized or awarded the Conspicuous Gallantry Cross for bravery for combat actions, specifically for that tour. So, you know, I'm condensing 10 years here and all the other things that we did, and, you know, the training and everything else, and you know, into quite a succinct time period. But yeah, it was busy.
How were you seeing yourself develop as an individual? I mean, you know, were you noticing changes, I guess, in your interests and your mindset and in your psyche?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have changed and developed and grown so much. And it always strikes me as odd when people, you know, if you don't see people for a while and they say, well, you've changed, haven't you? And almost like it's a negative. And it's just like, I don't understand that. You know, if you're not developing and growing as a person, you know, I just, what's the fucking point? I don't understand it. But for me, that, you know, like I said earlier, the Marines kind of set that base level, that foundation. It set me up for success in terms of soldiering ability and what I knew that my body and mind was capable of. And then Special Forces is just another level above that, another layer. And everything that I did in that 10-year period, from the training, you know, the people that I met, the leaders that I was surrounded with, you know, there's amazing people to my left and to my right, you know, up and down as well. I was very fortunate to be surrounded by super capable, very proficient individuals at different levels. So, you know, from a boss, you know, an officer, all the way down to the people to your left and your right that were very, very experienced individuals. And, you know, what I've learned in life is just to attach yourself to those kind of people that you aspire to be, the people that you look up to, people that you can learn from, you know. And I've done that my whole life and my whole career, and I still do it to this day. So, you know, trying to be very conscious of who I'm surrounded by, who I'm listening to, whose advice I'm taking, why I'm taking it. Is it the correct advice? And does it help me? Is it allowing me to understand myself better or enable me to be in a better position?
Do you think you did it as proactively back then? And I guess, you know, a bit of context, like, you know, I often get asked about, you know, who mentors have been throughout my career, or, you know, how I behaved when I was younger. And look, you know, when I look back, I'll always say, you know, I had these particular people who were mentors to me, or, you know, this was a, you know, a way that I behaved, which, you know, in hindsight was the right way to behave. But I think, you know, during my 20s, it was more by accident than by design, if that makes sense. And so, like, now if you ask me who my mentors are, I can say, well, these are my mentors.
Yeah.
I understand the concept of mentorship. I actively seek these people out. You know, like in my early 20s, I was just fortunate to be, I guess, be humble enough or intelligent enough to decide to link onto some people and latch onto some people. But, I mean, did you think you knew what you were doing back then?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few very good points you've raised there. One around the humility and probably the EQ side of things as well. So having that intelligence to understand yourself and understand and be open to learning and developing. So yeah, at the time, look, when I joined the Special Forces, you know, it's like, I guess, joining if you're a professional team, a rugby team or a football team, you would, you know, instantly look to who you aspire to be. What kind of player do I want to be? Who has similar characteristics or who has the characteristics that I want to be? And yeah, I say, I don't think it's fortunate. You know, you work very hard. I worked incredibly hard to get to where I wanted to get to, you know, in terms of the Marines and then the Special Forces, you know, and it's not a mistake then that, you know, you are surrounded by incredible people. So I was fortunate in that respect that I was surrounded by incredibly gifted individuals and leaders and everything else. But, you know, it was by design. I put myself into that position. I think, you know, as an example, like I remember on my first maritime counterterrorism training cycle that I did. So whenever you're in the Special Forces, you're constantly going around a cycle, whether if you're not deployed in operations, you know, you're training, you know, or you're becoming skilled at something else. I was a demolitions expert, so I was on a course for that. Or if I'm not doing that, and then I'm training. And, you know, we cover the role model for protecting offshore energy installations, you know, the gas and oil facilities that are offshore in the North Sea. And, you know, if one of those is taken, then, you know, our guys will be pulled forward and looked towards as a military option to take back that oil installation. And we have ways and means and methods of getting onto these offshore energy installations. And, you know, a particular skill set within the special boat service is either boats and or diving. You know, we're all combat swimmers. So on this particular sort of bleak winter morning, we were going out, you know, full mission profile, all our kit and equipment that we would do for a real job, you know, and we went around under an oil rig, and there's certain techniques you do before you sort of shoot the ladders onto the spider deck, the lower deck, before you climb, and maybe, you know, 30 feet climbing full kit on a caving ladder to get onto the, you know, gain access, and then off you go onto the mission. And for me in particular that day, it was horrendous. The weather conditions were horrendous, you know, subsurface. It was a big high swell, you know, there was ripping tides. And I remember going around the stanchion and, you know, being pulled into what I can only describe as a huge washing machine, and instantly sort of feeling that sense of being tiny and small and insignificant in that moment, and not really in control of what was happening. You know, the elements, Mother Nature had me, and I was attached to another guy as well, and we were just slamming up against the stanchion, and I actually got inverted round the other way. My arm went across my throat, and I actually cut the air supply off to my rebreather set. And I knew what was happening, but I couldn't right myself back the other way because the force of the tide was pulling me so hard. I was at sort of full extension. And I remember sort of having a moment of what the fuck is going on, and almost panic setting in. And I remember looking across to my dive partner, who at the time was a senior team leader within, you know, the squadron I'd already deployed with him in Afghanistan, and he was exceptional. And I remember looking at him, and he sort of tapping his glasses and just getting me to look in his eyes. And he was like, relax, you know, just fucking calm. And he had his arms crossed. He was in the same. He was getting swung around, but every so often he'd catch eyes and he'd be like, calm, just fucking stay calm. Don't worry about it. You'll be fine. You know, and having those people around you in moments of chaos, and that's all you need sometimes, that experience, you know, to level a situation, and it happens in business now as well, and it's happened multiple times throughout my military career. Those moments of quick stand back from the cold face, assess the situation. If there's anything that I can do, control the controllables. I mentioned it all in the book and kind of some of the key lessons and takeaways that have set me up for success moving forward as well. And in life in general as well, you know, very quickly people are quick to jump on and panic, and it's just, that doesn't help anybody or a situation, you know. And more often than not, you know, worry is the misuse of imagination, and there are ways to get out of a situation or ultimately make your situation better.
And tell me, talking about other scary incidents, because obviously when I was prepping for this, I read something about your parachute, like a parachute incident, a parachute not opening at 18,000 feet, something like that. What happened there?
Yeah. So it's probably the first chapter in the book, Leap of Faith. You know, we talk about leaps of faith in terms of like physically actually leaps of faith and then metaphorical as well. And for me, it was a full mission profile jump. So it was full gear, like we would jump on an operation.
Oh, so it wasn't an actual 18,000 feet. It was a test. It was a practice run.
It was a practice before we do an operation. So you'll practice all your kit and equipment, make sure everybody's good to go. You go through all the kind of usual stuff that you think. So it was a dry rehearsal before a real, you know, a real job. And on oxygen, 18,000 feet, obviously at night vision, all that kind of good stuff, all the weapon systems and all your kit fully laden, and stepping off the back, having a horrendous kind of exit. And, you know, I remember the parachute forming. It usually takes 8 seconds to form, and I'm going through the count in my head, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, usually to 8,000. You look up, check canopy, you do a left and a right turn, make sure you can steer the canopy, and then you'll do a flare to make sure you can break the canopy. And then you check all your technical bits of equipment to make sure that you're heading in the right direction, that you're stacked in behind the lads in the correct manner, and then you're off to your landing zone. And I just remember sort of going through the 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, something doesn't feel right, trying to look up. My oxygen mask had been ripped off due to the force and the of exiting, and kind of trying to look up, but I couldn't. And I realized I had low twists. So where your risers connect to the parachute, you know, you're obviously strapped into the parachute rig. You have the four lines each side that go up and meet the parachute. They were twisted all the way from my sort of just the back of my head all the way up to the chute. And, you know, there's things that you do. There's obviously we train and practice and rehearse drills for parachute failures. I knew what I had to do. I was kind of hanging my legs like a frog, for want of a better analogy, and pulling at the risers and kicking the opposite way out so that they would start untwisting, which they started to do slightly. I could now look above, and I've got probably what I can best describe as a bag of washing above my head. It's not a fully formed canopy. It does start to open up partially. Obviously, I'm dropping like a stone. I'm losing a lot of height, so I'm keeping check of my altimeter. And just as it starts to form, one of the sides then collapses in. It then puts me into a big, violent sort of G-force spin. And at that stage, you know, I know I have to get off the canopy. I've got to cut away and access my reserve canopy. So sort of having that moment of shit, you know, there's, what do you try and land with this above you and you might be all right, or do you chant, you know, it should work?
What's everybody else doing at this point?
You know, potentially the parachute might not open.
So the other people, are they kind of watching
in a stack? Yeah, so a few people have seen me. So like I said, we all jump out one after the other like lemmings off the back of the air platform. You can generally see where people are, and you're dropping at the same height, your parachutes are forming, and the idea is that you generally open at a similar height, slightly. People in front of you will be obviously slightly lower than you. You then do your checks, and then you line up with the other people. But everybody could see that, you know, wherever I was in the stack. So let's say I'm number 8 of 15, the first 7 will see nothing because they're in front of me. The guys behind me, though, can see that I'm dropping like a stone and I'm losing altitude very quickly. They try to, also my communications have been ripped out as well, so they're trying to talk to me. And I was trying to press and say, look, I've had a malfunction, but that obviously wasn't working. But yeah, thankfully for me, you know, I located the sacred handle and had an opening on the other parachute in the canopy. And as the irony of it all, I think I had probably one of the best parachute landings I've ever had in my military career, but slightly short of the landing zone.
I mean, tell me, you know, we talk about, I guess, you know, not getting stressed about the things that you can't control. And you said something, you said the words to the same effect a minute ago, you know, when we were talking about the underwater problem. How do you deal with stress when, for example, it's something you can't control, but it is really that life and death? So, you know, like, I don't know, parachutes out of control. You know, you don't even know if you can get to the backup chute, etc. You know, it's not about being calm and then following procedures. You're probably just fucked anyway. You know, I mean, do you still think you can keep calm and keep some kind of control in those circumstances? I mean, I guess you must have looked death down the eyeballs on more than one occasion.
Yeah, it's a good question. There is obviously moments of, and we've probably, if you've ever been involved in an accident or a car, you know, a road traffic collision or something, where people have that moment of everything slowing down and you're having those thoughts. You probably, I think, the brain's capable of 4,000 thoughts of a bloody minute or something crazy, isn't it? So you definitely have that moment. I'll give you an example. You know, I was in a particularly bad contact. It was actually in the daytime, which is unusual for us to be operating in the day, but we were. I was on a forward-facing slope, quite exposed. You know, I had my sniper rifle, you know, sweating buckets. It's the summer, it's Afghanistan, and we've been under contact for quite some time now. And I just had, you know, having those moments of feeling like, you know, it doesn't matter what I do or what I think here. There's just, you're in a bad spot. You know, you're in a bit of a pickle, and there are, you know, rounds kind of bouncing around you, like, you know, sort of Pulp Fiction style. And it's a case of, you have a decision to make, and what kind of person. I always looked at myself, and I did this, and I didn't realize till later on in my life, in my career, that I was actually practicing visualization quite a lot. You know, and I started doing it at football. For the most part, it was always positive. You know, 95% of the visualization that I was doing was positive, and it was, what type of person do I want to be? How would I view myself in this situation? What if this happens? What if that happens? How do I want to conduct myself? How do I want to come across to people? And I did this in my football career, and then I did it later on in the military as well. And I would sort of, when I was really, really struggling, and, you know, selection just puts you in some disgusting places mentally and physically. And, you know, for the most part, visualization helped with that, because I would say to myself, how would a special forces operator conduct themselves? How would they hold themselves? How would they appear to be? Would they be feeling sorry for themselves? Would they be negative? You know, would they just let everything, their professional standards, drop? They wouldn't, you know. And for me, that allowed me to push through that stuff. So, you know, when the rounds are hitting in this particular contact, for me, it was a case of saying, well, if this is it, it's it, and there's nothing I can do here. And it is back to the controllables. It's not going to help anybody, myself in particular, running around, you know, crying, screaming, shouting. You have a moment of acceptance, I guess. But that's a really extreme kind of scenario and situation. But I've had it throughout in, you know, the military and courses and situations where, you know, being calm in those situations, you know, you have to train that as well, and you have to visualize how you want to react in certain situations.
So let's talk about leaving the army. I mean, how did that come about? You know, what had changed? You know, what was your plans for next?
Yeah, I think, and probably just to sort of wrap that part up, I think for me, the military gave me I'm very fortunate, you know, for the people that I met and everything that it allowed me to do, and the experiences and opportunities, and the doors that it opened were incredible, and some fantastic memories. And I think what it gave me is a very unique perspective on life, on things. You know, I remember coming back from I think I was, it's on an R&R period, so a rest and recuperation during a 6-month operational tour. You go home for 2 weeks, which is odd, but it's obviously for tax purposes, not really that they're that bothered about the individual, but they have to break you out. Or they say it's for rest and recuperation, but who wants to go home for 2 weeks when they've been, you know, operating in the madness for that long? You know, it's just an unwelcomed, strange feeling. But I do remember landing back in the UK, you know, not less than 24 hours before that, maybe less than that. I'd been in a huge firefight. And the next thing, I'm in Starbucks in London, you know, and I'm getting, you know, people moaning in front about a lukewarm coffee, and, you know, just having this moment of, fuck, you know, perspective. It's everything. It's weird. And, you know, so leaving the military for me in 2018, I finished as my last 2 years. I was the chief sniper instructor. for the whole unit. So I was involved with the training and operational deployment of the squadrons for long range shooting, but I was also a small arms fire instructor as well, from pistol to close quarter combat stuff. And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the element of training and teaching people and passing on knowledge. I enjoyed it. But I think for me, I was 13 years in. We signed an open engagement contract for 22 years in the military. You know, you then put in a 1 year's notice to leave beforehand, and then the military take that 1 year. And we'll, depending on how long you've done, you have built up learning credits and money that you can put towards courses, university courses, or if you want to be an electrician, you can be enrolled on for a year onto an electrician's course. But for me, I think the wind had just been sort of taken out of my sails. I think I had 13 years, but 10 in particular, my more formative years, you know, within the SBS that had really shaped me and my career. And I just thought I've kind of ticked the majority, if not all, of the boxes that I wanted to tick. You know, I'd had such an amazing time and a fantastic career. And also it had taken a toll on, you know, my first marriage. You know, I'd met a partner at a very young age, at 18, married super early, 21. You know, we had a kid, my eldest Lucas, who's now 11. And we went all through that whole process together. And you know, it just took a huge toll. And I thought, you know, then as I was leaving, you know, we were separated for a couple of years. And I met my now wife, Ruby, and I just thought, I don't want to see this happen again. You know, I've found somebody, you know, special. And what does life look like on the outside for me? And when do I want to leave? Do I want to leave on my own terms, or do I want to leave on other people's terms? And I saw a lot of people that were in the job that were staying on later and longer, that weren't actually enjoying the jobs that they were doing. And as you get older and the more experience you gain, rightfully so, you'll then move further and further back, you know, from that tip of the air. And you know, you've got an important job. You're looking after the guys, and you know, planning and training, and you know, you're one of the bosses, and you have sergeant major level bits and pieces. But it didn't really appeal to me as an individual. And I think leaving it, you know, in 2018, I was what, 33 at the time. I still had what I felt is a good crack at the whip to do something different. You know, I still had a lot of energy and a new chapter that I felt I could still provide a lot of passion and purpose into something new. So in 2017, I started thinking about it more. My friend and business partner, co-founder of Through Dark, Louis Tinsley, was also in the SBS. His situation was slightly different. We were actually parachuting out in America training at the time, and he was being medically discharged for his back. So he was leaving, his kind of hand was forced, and we started talking about, I sort of said, look, I think I'm ready to leave as well. You know, I've had an amazing career. I've done everything I wanted to do. What could we do if we left? Should we set something up? Should we, you know, the obvious, I think, more natural transition for us with our skill sets is to go into private security. You know, our skills are very transferable, highly paid jobs, looking after people. And we did a bit of that when we left, you know, and we were cherry picking jobs, working for the NBA, and, you know, we were doing the Super Bowls, we were doing basketball, high profile stuff. And it was fun, it was good. And I was surrounded by, again, those like-minded people from, you know, former Special Forces guys, and it was safe, and it was something that I knew, and I could obviously clearly just move straight into. But I think for me and Louis, we wanted something different, and we loved the outdoors, we loved, you know, technical clothing and bits and pieces. And we started talking about, actually at the time we were parachuting again, and I was having issues with kit and equipment and a jacket. And actually during that parachute failure that we spoke about in the first chapter of the book, you know, the jacket, you know, to add insult to injury, the zip had blown as well, and the sort of jacket was flailing in my face, and it was a high-end technical piece of kit. And we were sort of critical about how things were performing, and being from a sniper background, we were sort of kit pests. We were always tinkering and playing with our own kit and equipment to make it more fit for purpose. And for us, when we looked at it, you know, semi-objectively, we thought that we have a lot of credibility, authenticity, and experience in operating in all these different environments in the world, from the cold, you know, the Arctic, to the desert, to the jungle, Scotland, you know, all these places that we'd operated and thrived in. We thought, and we loved the outdoors. Well, why don't we just make technical outdoor clothing? How hard could it be, you know, naively? And I think, you know, you need a bit of naivety, don't you? You know, you'll know this as well, Matt. And it's, you, whenever you're starting something new, whether it's military or whether it's business, you need that level of, you know, let's get stuck in. And you kind of work things out as you go along. But again, there were transferable things from the military that we learned that are in the book that really helped us plan and focus in the best possible ways. And I was fortunate because, you know, I had Louis by my side as well, who's exceptional, you know, very, very good. And we're actually quite different in terms of who we are and why our strengths and weaknesses lie as well. And they complement each other very well. And I think that's been one of the main, is the main key to what has been ThruDark's success as well.
So when you started ThruDark, I mean, like I say, you wanted to go and do something that you enjoyed, that you knew about, that you loved. But I mean, did you really feel like an entrepreneur? Was it a big plan to be a business owner, or was it just we need to go and do something, we need to make some money, I think this might make some money?
Yeah, probably at the start, what begins in its infancy as probably a lifestyle brand, as it was. You know, we love being outside, love climbing. Well, let's make clothing and equipment that we like, that we think is cool, that's different. And for us, it was looking at other competitors in the market and saying, well, you know, who's technically very good? Okay, those guys. But they kind of look the same. Everything's the same. Well, how can we make it look cool like those guys? And there's nobody operating in that space. There's got really technical suit, you know, capable outdoor kit and equipment that also looks different, that's very unique in its approach, that also has our story and our authenticity again and credibility. So off we step with the business plan. We got other people involved, and at the time a good friend of ours, personal friend, Steve Clark, he's a local businessman, very successful individual, Clark Investment, and I'd been introduced to him through another friend, and we've been friends for a couple of years, you know, it'd be food and drinks, the usual stuff, and I kind of understood what he did but not fully. And I think he heard me and Louis talking, you know, in the pub, we're having dinner together, and I probably was all good plans are formulated over too many pints, and he sort of, you know, lent his ear and said, guys, you know, I know you're both leaving the military now, what are your plans, you know, what do you want to do? And we sort of explained the idea of ThruDark and what it would look like, where it would sit, where our experiences, you know, lent themselves, and also, and you know this as well, with investment into people, you know, you're investing into, yes, an idea, but more importantly, the people behind it. We proved ourselves in so much that, not from a business perspective, but as individuals. And I think, again, going back to my original statement saying that, you know, the military and the special forces in particular had set us up for success. We had very unique and credible characteristics that, you know, he could see that in us. He could see that drive, that determination, that passion. But, you know, he could also see that there was logic there as well. And it wasn't just madness. So we came to him, you know, a couple of days later with a business plan, and we started talking about it. And he said, look, guys, I'm an investor. I'm your friends, first and foremost. But he said, I kind of believe in you two, first and foremost. You're very driven. You're very capable individuals. I like your idea. Shall we do it? You know, let's go for it. So we did. And at that stage, myself and Louis both invested all of our savings. You know, Steve put an initial founding investment in, and we were off to the races. And you know, that first year, it's crazy. I think looking back now, we had help and support from other people, and, you know, leaning into things that we knew or people that we knew in our network and social media profiles and people such as Foxy and Ant and all these people helping us, you know, really did sort of give us, a level heading. And also we had that kind of unique story behind us as well. No one had done this before, and we were plugged into different people, and we're quick learners, you know, and I think looking back now, over the past 6 years, we've probably had the best business course that you can have, I guess.
And tell me, we talk about raising money and getting the money to start it up. Did I read correctly that you had to sell your military medals to assist in the finance of this as well?
Yeah, so that was an element of that, and that was a difficult decision, obviously. But I think, you know, I learned a lot from that, and looking back now, and I mentioned it in the book as well. But in terms, I think the chapters are titled "Medals Are for Mothers." But I think for me, it was a difficult decision. But when I actually worked things out logically and removed emotion from the decision making process, for me personally, I was thinking it's actually a very logical thing to do, because at the time I was leaving, so I was spinning so many plates, leaving the military, leaving special forces, trying to set up a business, going through a messy divorce and a financial settlement that was attached to that. And I was in the courtroom, and actually my ex-wife, you know, their solicitors had brought the medal into the proceedings and attached it to a part of the financial settlement. Now, they went and got that valued. I'd never had it valued or would never think of selling it. And as soon as I understood what that value was, and they explained it as well. It's like a piece of art, you know, that you, that also, you know, whether you like it or not, and emotions removed, that should be put into the financial settlement. And the, you know, I didn't think they would, but the judge agreed. He said, yeah, well, it is. And we won't force you to sell that medal. But if you ever do sell that medal, then, you know, she's due half of it. So I thought, well, where am I at right now? I'm leaving the military. I'm moving into the unknown. I need funds. I need a clean financial break, financial settlement break. I don't have the funds myself. I've got some own personal debt that I need to get rid of. And this could really set me up for success. So, and also the money that was used from the medal, it paid, you know, it cleared the mortgage for her and my son at the time. So for me, that was the right thing to do. That was a good thing to do and a noble thing to do. And the right, you know, she deserved that as well. It cleared her debts, gave her a little bit of extra cash. It cleared all my debts, and it left me a little bit of money as well at the end to then put into ThruDark. So when I looked at it logically, you know, look, drowning sailors don't hold on to gold bars. And at the time, I was drowning and spinning plates. So, you know, whether or not I'll regret that later on, I don't know. I don't attach my identity or worth to trinkets, you know, and it's, I know that I've had the recognition for what I've done. And for me, that's everything. It means more than a piece of metal.
I like that expression, drowning sailors don't hang on to gold bars. I mean, obviously, you know, conceptually, I've been there more than a few times myself, but I've never actually heard that expression. I'll be making a note of that for an Insta quote later.
Yeah, but you know, it did. Looking back now, it was ultimately the right decision to make for me personally.
So talk to me about the kind of, you know, formative years or months of ThruDark. You know, how did you start the business? You know, did you go looking for suppliers, manufacturers? You know, did it start with just a couple of pieces of clothing? How did you get distribution? You know,
probably everything. It's a good question because it's like the death of a thousand cuts. Nothing happens, you know, overnight. And I think in this generation that we live at the moment, and social media is a great tool if you use it in the correct manner, but oftentimes it can be quite damaging as well, because people don't want to understand that business is hard and things take years to build, and they just want a quick fix or a solution to something. And it's similar to the gym or training, and it's the same with, you know, you've probably heard that, you have heard the saying that, you know, if you keep going and keep working hard, you know, in 10 years you'll be an overnight success. And there is an element of that looking back now, in, you know, after sort of 6 years or towards 7 years, and the business is in a great position and growing really well. But in the beginning, you know, you're doing everything. You're spinning plates. It's not too dissimilar to any other startup or entrepreneur. You're learning on the job. You're making mistakes. You're failing, but you're failing fast, and you're failing forward, and your understanding and your ability to learn and adapt to that change is part of it, and very similar to the military as well. So, you know, at the beginning, Louis went out to China, of all places, went to Guangzhou, went to the biggest sort of fabric and textile convention. At the time, I was still serving. I was about to leave. You know, I was getting messages from him. I'm meeting all these people, your suppliers. And it's difficult at the beginning because you're not established. You're not a business. You know, you've got a business card, which doesn't really lead to much. There's no footprint. There's no website. There's a website, but a landing page. You know, there's no social media following or gathering. And, you know, so we started down this process. And to cut this sort of condenser, what is a very long and complex story, and make it as succinct as possible, we met a British designer called Jeff Griffin, went to his farm in Loveland, like an eco retreat. I had a strange first interaction with him. He's a designer, very good. We loved his stuff. He then took us out to Italy to an incredible factory, to a factory we still use to this day, you know, and they were producing for high-end fashion brands, Moncler, Chanel, Fendi, but they're ski and outdoor wear. So we were in a good place. And we started going through the design process with Jeff, the ideas that we had and what the aesthetic, what we were wanting to look like, the materials. We were doing everything, looking at everything. And it was brilliant, you know, it was exciting. And then we get our first few samples, you know, after a couple of months, and we're trying to build a social platform. And one of the key or unique benefits for us is we were designing, developing, and then testing the clothing ourselves. And we were trying to storytell through social media platforms. So Instagram and the like, we would show people what we were designing, what the thought process was from the materials, the trims and everything, and what we were designing the jacket to for. And then we would go out, you know, to Scotland, we'd climb, we'd hike, we'd do all this stuff, put it through, you know, put it through the ringer. And then we would make tweaks and changes and amendments. And, you know, thankfully we've refined the process now through having, you know, surrounding ourselves with subject matter experts. But, you know, back in the day, I think the first Parker that we launched the brand in, you know, 2018 in May, So just coming into the height of summer, we had three products, and this wasn't by design. We were due to launch in the December, but we had technical issues with the website. It was all, everything was delayed. The manufacturing was delayed. And we launched with an Arctic parka, a hybrid jacket, and a pullover jacket. And, you know, people thought we were mad, or it was by some design that we were launching an Arctic parka coming into the height of summer, which is madness. But we had three products and some a couple of baseball caps, T-shirts, and some merchandise. But, you know, we were kind of off to the races. And then over time, you develop, you tweak, you change, you understand processes better, fabric cutting. You know, you have to understand every process. And, you know, that's something that Louis jumped into on the product side. And for me, I was focusing on the brand and the social and the content and all that kind of stuff. And we kind of developed our own kind of swim lanes, but obviously overlooking and checking each other off constantly. And, you know, before we know it, we start growing. There's two of us, then there's three of us. And I remember back in the first days, you know, getting those first orders in, and the excitement and the buzz, and I'll pack it and I'll do it. And, you know, you're just, you're doing everything, and it's amazing. But, you know, as with businesses and anything, I think, you know, we've been growing year on year. We've been doubling every year, and it's been incredible. But where now, as I stand here today, I'm looking left into towards the office. We're just about to move office again at the moment. We're just actually, that's why I'm sat in the hallway. I'm usually up in one of the meeting rooms or the think tank. You know, we're so busy here. We've got 35, 40 staff, you know, all running around, incredibly busy. We're moving all of our, well, outsourcing, resourcing all of our goods in and out. So that's a huge project. And I think for me, it was just over time, we developed more products. How do we make it better? How do we get better materials? And as you grow as a business and understand things better, you know, you start getting equity with other people and fabrics and mills and manufacturing capabilities and everything else. And you start to understand that. But, you know, now we've got a huge team that's helping us, and everybody that we brought into the business is super skilled, and we're surrounded by good people that all have a similar passion and purpose.
So in your military career, obviously you've had, you know, many, you know, life or death type experiences, and, you know, and anyone who's been in business has very much probably experienced that fine line between making big money and bankruptcy. I mean, have there been any particular, yeah, you know, like say business life and death scenarios that you've encountered over the last few years that you've either being able to apply your military learnings to get through, or that you've just, you know, just gotten through in other ways?
Yeah, a combination of a few of those things. But look, I think back to the, you know, Steve Clark and our investor, I remember sitting in what was our first board meeting, you know, quote unquote board meeting with Steve, and up in his office. I mean, we started in my front room of a rented property that I was having at the time. We had a whiteboard, long-term borrow that, you know, all the plans on, and we were planning everything like a military operation in terms of how we would do everything, how we saw the, you know, the brand and the vision, you know, a year to 3 to 5, 10 year goals and plans. And we still got a picture of that on my phone actually after, and it's not too far off, which is good to see, you know. And but what Steve did is he really did set us up for success, and he laid the foundations at an early stage. So I remember sitting in for our first board meeting after maybe 3 months in, after our go live date, and I'm sort of sat at the board meeting, just me and Louis in this kind of room that's too big for us, with Steve, and he's got a P&L up and a spreadsheet. And I'm just thinking, what the fuck is all this? What are all these numbers? And obviously we're 3 months into it, so it's tiny. It's a small P&L. You know, there's hardly anything on there, hardly any trading. But he was like, look, guys, this, and he could see me sort of looking, and I was like, oh God, this looks like it. This isn't a bit of me. This is, you know, terribly boring. And he was like, you will learn to love this. He was like, as I'm telling you, you'll love data, and you will love a P&L, and you'll love spreadsheets once you understand it, and you'll understand how important it is and how important it is to manage cash and cash flow. And, you know, we were fortunate in so much that when we moved from my front room, he gave us a small office space on the top floor of Link House in Poole. And, you know, very quickly throughout the year, 2 years that we were there, we started taking over the whole floor. We had access to his staff, access to his accounts department and other bits and pieces, and Steve in particular as well, who, you know, was helping us. And, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, when you start a business or a brand, you just want to get out. You know, I just want to do the cool stuff. Yeah, I just want to be climbing. I want to be testing the kit and equipment. I want to be designing. I want to be traveling here and there and doing all the fun stuff. And actually, you know, a lot of the stuff that's very important is cash. You know, I mean, cash is king. And I think, you know, I might be wrong here, but I saw a statistic in terms of the number one reasons why businesses fail, and it is because they run out of cash. You know, we've been in a fortunate position that we've always been good at managing cash because of the people that we've had around us. That's not to say that we haven't had instances where your trade loans are off, or you're missing stuff, and your forecast is wrong. You know, forecast is wrong the day that you forecast, isn't it? But you know, we've been fortunate with it. We've had help and support from investors and Steve and other people as well, so, and the bank. But for the most part, we've managed cash really well, and we've traded through what has been difficult periods as well. But for us, you know, there's things that weren't even on the whiteboard, or that we looking down the tracks, what's coming, you know, most likely course of action, most dangerous course of action. You know, we can plan for everything, but certain things you don't plan for, economic, you know, downfall, or you know, coronavirus. But actually, coronavirus worked the opposite for us. It actually helped us, you know, and we were probably more luck than judgment. We were stocked at the time from Italy. Italy then got hit. You know, the factories were all shut, and we were off to the races. We just pumped more cash into advertisement, you know, and switched how we were communicating and making access to the garments. And, you know, it took off really well. But then we were looking at the out of stock and the notifications and the run rates and stuff. And, you know, we were going to hit a point where we need to start manufacturing, or, you know, we're not going to have a business. So again, you know, Italy reopened and we were still in lockdown. We could start manufacturing again, et cetera, et cetera. So there have been instances where there have been moments of, fucking hell, we're going to have to just, you know, bite down on the gum shield or do up the chin strap and just fucking get on with it.
How big's the business now? I mean, can you tell us figures? I mean, I don't know what's public knowledge, what isn't. You know, can you talk about size, turnover, anything?
We haven't published stuff, but I think we're going to have to soon. We've just had another round of investment, actually, from Al Barrett, who owns Grenade. He's just invested as well.
Okay.
Founding investor Steve's put some more money in. I'm not sure when we're going to publish stuff like that, but I think valuation's around about £20 million. So it's all shaping up and moving in the right.
And how does that make you feel? I mean, is it something that, you know, has kind of hit you? You know, do you take a step back and go, you know, I was a lost kid who, you know, went to the army, never thought I'd be going off in business, and I'm now an owner of a £20 million business. I mean, is it registered?
No, I don't think so. Not really. I think because the type of people that we are, I'm not speaking for Louis but myself, but I'm pretty sure I've heard him verbalize it before. I think it's, we just want to keep going. You know, we're just so hell-bent on producing the best quality products that we can. And, you know, how do we improve the business day to day? And you've just got to be relentless. Every day, your morning, you wake up, you swing your legs out of the bed, you need that passion, you're aiming towards something, and you're just fucking relentless. And I think, because you're so busy and engrossed and day to day, there's not many times that you do actually take stock and stand back. You know, there are moments that when I do come in and I look and I feel immense, you know, pride, you know, in terms of what we've achieved and how we've got here and the people. But mainly for me, it's around the people that we're surrounded by. And I think we had a moment, it was our 5-year anniversary. Not long ago, and we kind of, you know, we celebrated that across social media, but also we took everybody out and we went for food and drinks, and that was probably a moment where I sort of stood back and was like, because you're always worrying in business, you're always have that fucking worry in the back of your head, is it a flash in the pan? Is it going to work? Is it going to be successful? It could fail at any moment. Are we going to run out of money? What if people stop buying the product? What if somebody doesn't like something? What if we, you know, it's all, and then you have the other pressures of staff and you know, it's not just yourselves anymore, it's other people's livelihoods that are at risk, and you know, you have a lot of pressure, you know, and rightly so. You know, pressure, it is a privilege, but at times, you know, you know, you put yourself in that situation, and yes, you can reap the rewards of being a business owner and being successful, but you know, there's always something there nagging that makes you want to keep pushing and pursuing a greater good, I guess. So yes, we have taken stock of it, but I get, you know, but not for long. I think you think about it and you keep moving, you know, the train keeps moving.
What's your particular role in the business in terms of, you know, are you the CEO, or have you recruited a specialist CEO?
I am, yeah, so we've actually just recruited, probably, yes, it is our top hire, our biggest hire. It's a CEO, Chris Reynolds. He's a great stock, great caliber, an amazing individual, incredibly bright, and an amazing addition to Through Dark. He's somebody that's been involved with the business from the very start. He's been Steve Clark's kind of right-hand man. He's now a partner in the Clark Investment Group. And Chris has been somebody, again, as I talk about those people that we invite and bring around the table for advice, Chris has always been leaning in and dialing in and patching into calls and always been at the end of the phone for advice whenever we needed it. And somebody that you'd always want in your business, that kind of person, but we could never afford him, first and foremost. And two, he was busy, you know, he had another job. So, you know, another one of Steve's investments, Bremont Watches, you know, a luxury UK brand watch company. Chris was pulled away to work for those guys, I think initially to sort of help them out for a short period of time, maybe a month or two. He ended up staying three to four years, you know, completely turned that business around, and everybody else there as well. And they've just sold and exited. So Chris was a free agent. So the timing worked really well for us. We've had some other big hires as well. You know, Tommy from as a brand director. We've had Ben, our product master. These guys have had years of experience in the industry, very knowledgeable, and don't just help in their roles, you know, in terms of, you know, their swim lane, for instance. They've got a huge amount of experience and knowledge and valuable insight across a lot of other touch points within the business. But, you know, for us, it was, getting Chris in as CEO. But for me personally right now, obviously myself and Louis are the co-founders. We oversee everything within the business. We've got sight of everything. Louis, though, day-to-day generally deals with the production side of things and operations. And for me, it's brand and marketing and sales. So day to day for me, that would include everything from content shoots, this kind of stuff, the website, social media, creative, marketing, all that kind of stuff, elbow tickling, all that kind of good bits and pieces. So Louis will work with the design teams and myself as well, have my input in terms of designs and tweak and amendment, but Louis kind of drives that home with his team. And then he did obviously has the operations, the finance side on there as well. But obviously finance is a function that leads in across all elements of the business and reports into the business as a whole. But, you know, we've got customer communication teams as well, which come under operations. So, yeah, it's busy, but we overlook everything. One of the things that I've learned is to know when to get the right people in at the right time. You know, you always stress and pressure test yourselves as a business as much as you can, because it's more money out and do we need it or do we want it right now and what is the timing right? So, you know, we've grown incredibly over the last 12 months. You know, I think we've gone from 8 people to 35 people. That's not including outsourced agencies as well, where, you know, we've got a lot of underground e-com help as well, and from everything from email, CRM, all this kind of stuff is outsourced because there's a lot of heavy lifting day to day. But I think that's probably 50 people all in with outside agency help as well. So, yeah, it's been busy. But for me, day to day, I am, well, technically I'm the CMO, for what it means. You know, I'm the co-founder, but I oversee brand and marketing and sales.
Well, let's have a little change of topic onto some of the glamorous stuff. Not that the world of business isn't glamorous, as I would say every day. I think it's 2021. You joined the cast of Who Dares Wins, SAS, as the undercover mole. I think this year as well, you know, you're part of the Australian setup alongside Ant Middleton, who was a recent guest on the show as well. I mean, where did that come from, and how was that for you?
Yeah, again, amazing opportunity that I'm really grateful for, and Ant's been a huge part of that. And it actually came around when we were back in Link House, myself and Louis were sort of just building 2021, like you suggested, and a call came through. A lot of the guys were wearing our stuff, the DS and Foxy and other people, and their costume department rang us up because they were speaking to Foxy, love the kit, what is it? Oh, it's Through Dark, Stars and Louis, ex, you know, Special Forces, give them a call. So when they rang us and talked about clothing, we presumed it was for the DS, but they said actually it's going to be for the recruits. And we said, well, that's not something that we want to kind of pursue in terms of brand. We want the DS wearing our stuff, not the recruits. And also what they were looking for, they just wanted cheap, really easy kind of military cargo stuff that's just going to get beasted. And, you know, budgets were super low. And I said, look, that's not what we do. We're a high performance technical outdoor brand. We don't make cheap fill in the blank trousers, you know, t-shirts, etc. So that didn't work out. End of conversation, phone down, you know, but thank you very much. And that was it. And then about 20 minutes later, the phone rang again, same person. Answered the phone, everything all right? And she said, look, we've just been talking with the cast and people and other, and everything else in-house. And have you ever considered or thought about coming on the show as a DS? And I was kind of, no, not a chance. Sort of laughed it off. Sort of not interested. Look, we're super busy. We started the business. We'll kind of leave that to Foxy and Ant and the guys. Put the phone down. And I remember sort of looking across the table at Louis. And he was looking at me and sort of saying, explain the conversation. And we were like, have we just kind of messed up there in terms of a marketing opportunity that is could be potentially huge for the brand? And I was like, maybe we should explore that. So email, call them back, look, let's have a talk. Let's look at how it could potentially look. Anyway, long story long, ended up going down for interviews in London, didn't really want to do it. But kind of could see the value in doing it and in terms of marketing and what the eyeballs and the mind share that would bring. So off I went. Next thing, I'm a mole, the worst mole in history, probably. I'm with the recruits, you know, trying to blend in with those guys. I do 6 days undercover, trying not to make eye contact with any of the guys while they're beasting us. And then I get revealed as actually, you know, undercover, and I've been kind of behind the scenes, sort of checking them out. I then join, you know, the DS as a DS. This is Channel 4 at the time. And then it was great. I then stayed on. I filmed the celebrity version after. It was brilliant. Had a great time. And then, subsequently left the show. I wasn't called up again, wasn't required. They were changing things around, different DS. I came back to Through Dark, was kind of like, yeah, that's brilliant. If we've kind of utilized that and maximized that opportunity, that's great. It was great for Through Dark. We used the assets and had a lot of web traffic, brilliant. And didn't think anything more of it, really, to be honest. And again, we're so busy with the business side of things and really thankful to Louis as well and sort of taking up my part and my elements of the work while, you know, in my absence. He's been brilliant for that. And then it wasn't until sort of last year, obviously Ant had moved on to Australia and gave me a call and just said, look, you know, I'm setting up in SAS Australia. How do you feel about coming on and joining the team? And again, it was an easy decision to make, I guess, you know, to get back on. And this time it was Ant, it was Ollie Ollerton, another incredible person, and Jay Morton as well, who I know and have worked with. So that was an easy decision to make. It was filmed in May in Jordan. It was a huge success. All the stuff has just been released now in terms of viewing figures. I think it's the best, most successful one that they've had. And, you know, and it's a big, big, huge part of that, as well as the chief instructor. He gets to sort of produce and direct and has a massive amount of input and sway. And the Australians as well, and Channel 7 and Endemol Shine, all these people were brilliant. You know, they allowed Ant and gave him that room to do what he does best, and us as the DS allowed us to support Ant as well in that mission, and it was amazing. I think we've just been commissioned for another show, so next year will be the next show of that. So it's exciting.
And is this going to be a big part of your future? You think you like the media, like these opportunities, or is it just to generate a bit of publicity for Through Dark?
Yeah, it's I like pushing myself. I like challenging myself. I like doing at the time. Rewind back to the Channel 4 conversation, you know, I really struggled and thought hard about it. Am I doing it for the right reasons, you know, and do I want to do it? Do I need to do it? What are the benefits? What are the negatives, you know? And look, it's not an easy decision when you leave our world and special forces, you know. It's not the done thing. You don't write books, you don't go on TV, you don't do all this stuff. And, you know, we have that element of the unspoken rules and bits and pieces. But I think when you leave in the world we live in right now, times have changed, you know. And again, if I look back to my original statement of why I joined the military, it was books that got me interested in joining the military. So there is actually some benefit in that in terms of recruitment and some of the positive messages that an inspiration that we can pass through social media platforms and books and TV programs. So when I thought about it, you know, it was an opportunity. I thought, well, let's scratch the itch and, you know, let's see what, you know, let's see where the chips fall after. And actually, I'm glad I did it and I enjoyed the process and I could see the benefits for me personally as well. But more importantly, for the brand, for Through Dark.
So tell me about the book. Obviously, we can't finish without the book. I mean, I know we've referred to some of the chapters and some of the activities, you know, whilst we've been having this chat. But where did the, not so much the idea, but I mean, when did you decide to write a book? And and what was the logic behind it at the time?
I think, you know, I started writing the books sort of 16 months ago. You know, when I looked at it and was approached by, you know, the agency and other people to write a book, again, it was something that I was like, not interested in. But, you know, what have I got to share? And actually, when my friends and other people sat me down and were like, look, you know, what you've actually done is there's actually quite an incredible story there in terms of your upbringing, you know, the football, the military, special forces, now into business, everything's going well in life, and the stories and the learnings that could be passed on there. So that was the kind of initial idea and the concept. And look, you know, again, kudos to Anne and Foxy and Ollie and Billy, the guys there that have really stuck their head above the parapet. And for me, they've really like blazed a trail for the rest of the people that do leave the military and want to pursue other careers as well. So, and in terms of writing the books, you know, Anne's had huge success and Foxy, and but they've been quite different in their books and their approaches and kind of their teachings and methodology and everything else. And, you know, Ant's a super positive, inspiring individual, and his books lean into that, you know, and the confidence side of things. And you know, Foxy talks about, you know, his battles and struggles that he had with mental health, which has obviously helped a vast amount of people, myself included. And for me, it was like, well, what can I add? What value can I add to people? And it's about, you know, when we break everything down, having that sort of self-belief in yourself, but also, you know, learning, you know, the title itself, like, The Hard Road Will Take You Home, was a mantra, something that was spoken to me atop a grassy hill by a commander at the time in the Royal Marines. It was something, the speech that he delivered, that, you know, you could hear a pin drop on this bottom field. And, you know, he talked about life and how difficult things are, and how putting yourself through adversity and difficult, challenging situations really do help you develop and form as an individual, you know. And he was sort of saying, look, you're in the right place right now. You've all chosen to be here for the right reasons. You know, this process is hard and it's difficult, but, you know, and as cliched or as it sounds, it's for him to say, sort of, don't take that easy option. Stop looking for shortcuts. The hard road will fucking take you home. Looking at things and not looking for an easy option, that's where the fucking beauty lies in life. And he's exactly right. And I've taken that mantra with me through life and everything that I've tried to apply it to everything that I do. And business is exactly the same as well. Stop looking for fucking short, easy, quick wins, because, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're exactly that, just a short, quick win that doesn't have longevity, that has nothing, no substance or no meaning. And, you know, I've actually learned quite a lot through the military that are applicable to life as well. So in each chapter, you know, I try and talk about or give you an example from life, from military, and from business. And there's a story from each one, and I attach it to that specific chapter in particular and talk about the things that I've learned, you know, hopefully that it comes across in the right manner. It's with humility and sort of, you know, my fuck ups, my learnings, you know, what I did right, what I did wrong, what I learned, how I've become better and developed as an individual as well, and how ultimately I've applied that now into business moving forward.
Did you have a particular process for writing the book, or did, you know, any of the other boys help you out with any of their ideas?
Yeah, so again, with everything in life, you need help, you need support, you know, and I've been very fortunate. I had an incredible ghostwriter, Matt, who was brilliant. He was actually Foxy's ghostwriter, who put me in touch with him, and he was Nims's ghostwriter. I think he did Usain Bolt as well. And, you know, I went through this process with Matt, and you know, there's a lot of this. At the time it was COVID, we were a lot of Zooms and chats and talking, and he kind of draws the information that he requires from me, and we kind of started shaping the book in terms of how I wanted it to look and be presented, my tone, you know, the things that I'd learned along the way, and how we would then structure the chapters and everything else. And you know, he was a huge part of that. You know, I had also help from inside here. I'd have friends, trusted opinions that I would lean into for advice on certain elements of the book or chapters, and Louis to cross-check things. I had George here as well, who works for us, who's an avid reader and again, a trusted opinion, a master of the written word, somebody that would give me honest, reliable feedback. And, you know, that, and it just takes ages, lots of tweaking, changing, and that doesn't sound right. That's not quite the message that I'm trying to get across. Can we tweak it, change it? And, you know, that's a long process. And it was actually, it was an enjoyable process as well, you know, to go through that. It was like nostalgic as well, thinking about the past and what it had taught me. And, you know, a lot of things that actually, upon reflection, have really helped me, and things that I thought I could pass on and hopefully pass on to other people as well through the text.
Well, we've talked a lot about mentors and mentorship throughout this conversation. I think, you know, just to wrap up with, for me, I'd like to, we've talked about people mentoring you or people mentoring me, but, you know, if you were to mentor someone now, and I'm sure you've got, you know, whether it's young people who look up to you or whether it's people in the business that ask you questions. If you were to give aspiring entrepreneurs and individuals, you know, just, you know, one piece of advice who are looking to achieve their goals, I mean, based on your remarkable journey of the military, of business and everything else you've done, what would that single piece of advice be?
That's very hard, isn't it? It's a great question, but very hard to single down into one thing. But there's actually... I'll take the title of the book, The Hard Road Will Take You Home. But I want to say to people that, you know, everything is possible. You can achieve everything as well. But I think for me, one of the main takeaways and one of the chapters is called How You Do Anything is How You Do Everything. And again, something else you can apply through life. Just think about doing how you do anything and applying that mentality, doing everything to the best of your ability. That's all that you can do. That's all that anybody can ever ask of you. And, you know, setting yourself up for success and not allowing yourself to be pulled off course. But, you know, if you can honestly say to yourself, that is the best that I can do right now with everything that I know and everything that I have at my disposal, there's nothing more that I can do. And I think that's a good thing to take through into, you know, into business and life as well. So really concentrate, whether you're sweeping the fucking floors, whether you're packing a parcel, you know, whether you're attending a meeting, whether you're looking at product development piece, bits and pieces, whether that's your life, whether you're training, your relationships, how you do anything is how you do everything.
Be the best. Yeah, whatever you are, just be the best. But, yeah. But listen, Staz, it's been an absolute pleasure, yeah. Pleasure to have you here, mate. Love talking, and I'm definitely going to love finishing off the book as well over the next few days. Just before you go, I mean, just give a shout. Actually, somebody in the live stream actually asked if you've got any plans for a UK tour, like the rest of the guys that tell your story. Maybe answer that and just give a little shout out to where people can get the book and follow you and everything else.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. Again, I've really enjoyed this one. Okay, yeah, so usual, sort of find me on all the usual social media platforms, Staz Through Dark, and then website, everything else. But the book in particular, click the link in my bios, but it's available at Amazon and Waterstones, all those kind of good retailers. The audiobook as well, apologies to people that have pre-ordered the audiobook. There's been a technical issue, so that should be rectified next week. I'm narrating the audio piece as well, but there's also some special guests after most of the chapters. I'm joined by a few special people as well to kind of talk on the chapter as well. But yeah, I think, that's it. In terms of the tour, I'm not sure yet. I think let's see how well the book does. Let's see how the uptake is. It's been really good, really strong and positive. And, you know, and thank you as well to Atlantic Books and Alan Unwin and everybody else that have helped out, and WF Howes, in terms of allowing me to sort of produce and publish the book. They've been incredible. Let's see how it goes. I'd love to do a tour. I'd love to do some book signings and meet people, because generally speaking, when we do things like Through Dark, what we've tried to do is bridge that connection between consumer and brand. And hopefully we've done that, you know, quite well through storytelling and being authentic and genuine and being ourselves. So, you know, I love it when we do open the doors, you know, HQ and lock days, and we get to meet, you know, meet people as well. It's something that I'm passionate about. So yeah, I'll get onto that. And as soon as there's any information, I'll release that.
Awesome. Well, listen, guys, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching. And if you've only joined halfway through this, you'll be able to catch the full thing over the next couple of weeks on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, wherever we normally post all our podcasts. So thank you very much for watching. And Staz, thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you.